Welcome to the History Maps podcast. Think about running a multinational corporation today.
Right.
You have a massive territory to manage and to keep things secure. You employ a private security force of roughly 135,000 heavily armed men.
That is a substantial workforce.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Now consider the business strategy of, you know, systematically cutting their relative pay.
Right.
Blocking them from ever reaching upper management, routinely insulting their core religious beliefs, and finally handing them a highly lethal brand new weapon.
I mean, that sounds like a textbook recipe for corporate suicide.
Exactly. Yet, this was the exact scenario engineered by the British East India Company in the year 1857.
It really was.
Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into the source material covering an event that completely shattered the largest corporate empire in human history, the Indian Rebellion of 1857.
It is a massive topic.
For you listening, our mission is to move past the superficial timeline.
Mm.
We want to unpack the deep mechanical and psychological failures that led to this complex conflict.
Right, because the scale of the East India Company by the mid-19th century is, it is often misunderstood.
Yeah. Clarify that for us.
We are not talking about a government entity in the traditional sense here.
Right.
We are talking about a joint stock company operating out of Leadenhall Street in London, which had somehow transitioned into the de facto sovereign ruler of the Indian subcontinent.
Which is just a wild concept to grasp today.
It is. And to enforce its will and, you know, extract its profits, it relied on three distinct presidency armies.
Okay.
The most crucial and the one at the center of our discussion today was the Bengal Army.
Let us establish the raw numbers, because the demographics here dictate everything that follows in the source.
Right, the numbers are key.
In the Bengal Army, you had approximately 135,000 Indian soldiers.
Yes.
The infantry were known as sepoys, and the cavalry were known as sowars.
Exactly.
Against that massive local force, how many European troops were actually stationed in that command?
Just 24,000.
24,000.
Yeah. Across the entire subcontinent, the total British military presence hovered between 34,000 and 40,000.
So the ratio was drastically skewed.
Drastically. The East India Company was policing a subcontinent of hundreds of millions of people using a military force where they were outnumbered by their own indigenous employees by at least 5 to 1.
That immediately raises a massive question.
Sure.
If you are entirely dependent on this local workforce to maintain your grip on power, logic dictates you treat them well.
You would think so, yeah.
You keep them happy, well-paid, and loyal. But looking at the internal mechanics of the company at this time and the sources, they were doing the exact opposite.
Right, they really were.
Let us dig into the systemic grievances, starting with the economics.
Well, the economic reality for an Indian infantryman in the 1850s was grim.
How grim?
A sepoy in the Bengal native infantry earned roughly 7 rupees a month.
Okay, 7 rupees.
For context, a standard British private soldier was pulling in the equivalent of 50 rupees a month.
50? That is a massive gap.
It is. And more importantly, that 7 rupee figure had been stagnant for decades.
Oh, wow. So no adjustments for inflation at all?
No, none. While the cost of living on the subcontinent rose, the sepoys' purchasing power just evaporated. Is barely subsistence wages.
And there was a hard ceiling on career progression too, right?
Very hard.
You could be a veteran sepoy with 30 years of combat experience, having fought in the Anglo-Sikh Wars or in Burma.
Right.
And you would still be outranked by an 18-year-old British ensign who just stepped off a boat from Southampton.
Yeah, we are talking about the restriction to subaltern ranks.
Define that for us.
A subaltern is simply a junior officer. In the East India Company Army, the absolute highest rank an Indian soldier could achieve was Subedar for the infantry or Rizaldar for the cavalry.
So those are technically officer ranks.
Technically, yes. But they were strictly subordinate to all British commissioned officers. An Indian Subedar, with decades of tactical knowledge, possessed zero authority to issue orders to a teenage British lieutenant.
That must have created an environment of profound professional humiliation.
It absolutely did. It was deeply resented.
So we have an underpaid, professionally stunted workforce.
Mm-hmm.
But the situation was compounded by who, specifically, these soldiers were.
Yes, the demographics are very specific here.
The company deliberately recruited from a very specific demographic pool for the Bengal Army, didn't they?
They did. The company preferred to recruit high-caste Hindus.
Okay.
Specifically Brahmins and Rajputs, largely from the rural agrarian regions of Bihar, Awadh, which is often spelled Oud in the historical texts and the northwestern provinces.
So why this specific group?
For these communities, military service was not just a job to pay the bills. It was a hereditary profession deeply intertwined with their caste identity and social prestige.
So it was a family tradition.
Generations of the same family would serve in the exact same regiment.
If the British knew they were dealing with a highly traditional, high-caste workforce, why pass the General Service Enlistment Act of 1856?
That is the big question.
Because this piece of legislation feels like a completely unforced error when you read the sources.
To understand the act, you have to understand the company's expanding footprint.
Right.
By 1856, the company was fighting wars outside of India, in Burma and China.
Right.
They needed troops who could be deployed overseas via ships. The Enlistment Act, which was pushed through by Governor General Lord Canning, simply mandated that all new recruits pledge a willingness to serve anywhere the company required.
Including overseas.
Including overseas.
Wait, I need to stop you there. From a modern military perspective, that sounds completely standard.
Sure, today it does.
When you join an army today, you agree to deploy where you are sent. Why was this such an incendiary piece of legislation for the Bengal army at that time?
Because for a high-caste Orthodox Hindu in the 19th century, crossing the ocean, which they referred to historically as the Kalapani, or Blackwater, was an act that resulted in the immediate loss of caste purity.
Really?
Yes, it was a profound cultural taboo.
Explain the mechanism behind that taboo. Why does salt water erase caste?
It was tied to the strict rules governing ritual purity, diet, and association.
Okay.
On a cramped wooden naval vessel, a high-caste soldier could not ensure that his food was prepared by someone of appropriate caste.
Right, you're sharing tight quarters.
Exactly. He could not perform the necessary daily ablutions with fresh water. He was forced into close physical proximity with lower castes, foreigners, and untouchables.
And what happens when he goes back home?
Upon returning home, he would be treated as an outcast. He would be barred from his family home, unable to marry off his daughters, and cut off from his community until he performed expensive, prohibitive purification rituals.
So the company is essentially telling their new hires, sign this contract, and we reserve the right to completely destroy your social standing, your soul, and your family's future.
That is exactly how it was perceived.
Even if the act only applied to new recruits, the veteran sepoys must have seen it as an attack on their entire way of life.
That is the exact psychological mechanism at play. The veterans viewed it as the company closing the door on their sons and grandsons.
Oh, I see.
It signaled that the honorable hereditary profession they had built was being intentionally dismantled. It demonstrated a total detachment by the British officer class.
The officers were detached from their men.
Completely. Decades earlier, British commanders were deeply pragmatic. They participated in local festivals, understood caste sensitivities, and accommodated dietary requirements just to maintain order.
That makes sense.
But by the 1850s, a rigid Victorian racial hierarchy had calcified. British officers actively distanced themselves from their men. They viewed their religious practices with open contempt.
And it was not just military policy that was causing friction. Let us move out of the barracks and look at the broader political landscape in the sources.
Right.
Because the company was aggressively rewriting the rules of sovereignty. And the primary weapon here was the doctrine of lapse.
The doctrine of lapse is crucial here. It was an administrative policy masterminded by the previous Governor General, Lord Dalhousie.
How did it work?
Before Dalhousie, if the ruler of a princely state in India died without a biological male heir, long-standing Hindu tradition and legal precedent dictated that the ruler could adopt a son.
Right.
This adopted son would inherit the throne, perform the necessary funeral rites, which are vital in Hindu theology for the deceased soul, and continue the dynasty.
And Dalhousie just decides to nullify a centuries-old tradition.
He weaponized it for corporate expansion. Dalhousie declared that the East India Company, as the paramount power, had the right to recognize or reject these adoptions.
Let me guess.
In practice, he almost universally rejected them. If a ruler died without a biological son, Dalhousie declared the state had lapsed, and the company simply annexed the territory.
They just took it.
They seized its treasury, its lands, and its administrative control.
The scale of that is quite severe. Mm. A private corporation is basically saying, your religious rites of adoption mean nothing to us. We are seizing your country.
Yes.
Which brings us to a specific annexation that fundamentally destabilized the Bengal army. The annexation of Oud in 1856.
The annexation of Oud is the critical catalyst. Oud was the primary recruiting ground for the Bengal army.
Right.
It was the homeland for tens of thousands of sepoys. When Dalhousie annexed it, he didn't even use the Doctor of Lapts. He simply claimed the local Nawab was governing incompetently.
Just flat out took it.
The company moved in, disbanded the Nawab's army, putting thousands out of work, and immediately instituted harsh land revenue reforms.
How did those reforms directly impact the sepoys who were serving the British?
The company bypassed the traditional landowning aristocracy, known as the Taludars, and imposed heavy direct taxes on the peasant farmers.
Mm.
The families of the sepoys back in their villages were suddenly facing economic ruin. The sepoys were receiving letters from home detailing how their lands were being heavily taxed, their local lords deposed, and their social structure upended.
So let us synthesize this based on the sources.
Okay.
You are a high-caste sepoy. You are paid a fraction of what your European counterpart makes.
Yep.
You can never get promoted.
Right.
Your British officers treat your religion with contempt. The company just passed a law threatening to send your sons across the Black Water and destroy their caste.
Yes.
And on top of all that, the company just invaded your homeland, deposed your king, and is taxing your family into poverty.
It is a lot.
You have a heavily armed, highly trained force pushed to the absolute psychological limit.
The structural conditions for a massive revolt were entirely in place. The system was completely saturated with grievance. It merely required a specific, deeply personal offense to act as the spark.
Let us talk about the spark.
Yes.
In February 1857, the military introduces a new weapon, the pattern 1853 Enfield rifled musket.
A very notable piece of technology.
Walk me through the physical mechanics of this weapon and why it caused such an explosion.
Well, the transition from the old smoothbore musket, the Brown Bess, to the Enfield rifle was a major technological leap. A rifle barrel has spiral grooves inside it to spin the bullet, making it much more accurate.
Right.
But for those grooves to grip the bullet, the projectile has to fit very tightly. To load this weapon quickly in the field, a soldier was issued a prepackaged paper cartridge containing the gunpowder and the bullet.
And because it's a tight fit, it requires lubrication.
Correct. The paper cartridge was heavily greased so the bullet could slide down the fouled barrel of the rifle.
Okay.
The loading drill required the soldier to physically bite the top of the greased paper cartridge off, pour the powder down the muzzle, and then ram the greased bullet home.
So the grease goes right into their mouths.
Yeah.
And rumors begin to circulate about what exactly that grease is made of.
The rumor that swept through the cantonments was that the grease was composed of a mixture of cow fat and pig fat.
The theological implications there are catastrophic.
Truly. For Hindu sepoys, the cow is sacred. Consuming its fat is a profound desecration. For Muslim sepoys, the pig is haram, forbidden. Touching or consuming its fat is deeply polluting.
A question that often comes up in the material is, was the rumor actually true? Did the British really use cow and pig fat?
Historical evidence suggests that animal tallow, including beef and pork fat, was indeed used by contractors in the arsenals at Woolwich in England, where the early cartridges were manufactured.
Just because it was cheap.
Simply because it was cheap and readily available. When the British realized the issue, they hastily tried to switch to beeswax and mutton fat and allowed sepoys to grease their own cartridges. But by then, it did not matter.
Because the trust was already entirely gone.
The factual reality of the grease's composition became irrelevant compared to the perception of the company's intent. In a colonial setting where the governing body has already repeatedly demonstrated cultural hostility, taking away adoptions, taxing lands, threatening overseas deployment, a rumor like this is not viewed as a bureaucratic oversight.
It is viewed as a calculated, deliberate weapon.
Exactly. The sepoys believed the British were intentionally forcing them to consume this fat to pollute them, strip them of their caste, sever them from their communities, and leave them with no choice but to convert to Christianity.
So it was perceived as a systematic campaign of cultural eradication.
Yes. Once a soldier believed that biting the cartridge meant eternal damnation and social death, military discipline evaporated. Became a matter of spiritual survival.
We see this boil over very specifically at the military cantonment in Barrackpore on March 29th, 1857.
Yes, a very famous incident.
This is the moment of Mangal Pandey.
Mangal Pandey was a sepoy in the 34th Bengal Native Infantry. Pushed to the brink by the rumors and the palpable tension, he armed himself, paced in front of the quarter guard, and openly called for his fellow sepoys to rise up in defense of their religion.
He just walked out and started calling for a revolt.
Yeah. And when a British officer, Lieutenant Bao, rode out to confront him, Pandy fired, hitting Bao's horse. A physical altercation ensued involving Bao, Sergeant Major Hewson, and Pandy.
And when the British ordered the Indian quarter guard to arrest Pandy, they refused.
They did. Only one soldier, Sheikh Paltu, intervened to protect the British officers. Eventually, Pandy tried to turn his weapon on himself, survived, was court-martialed, and hanged on April 8th.
The execution of Mangal Pandey and the subsequent disbanding of his regiment was intended by the British to be a severe display of authority, right?
That was the intention. Instead, it canonized him as a martyr. It proved to the rest of the Bengal army that the company would use lethal force to enforce the use of the polluted cartridges.
The tension simmers for a few more weeks. The British think they've handled it, but then we arrive at Meerut on May 10th, 1857.
Right, Meerut.
How does Meerut differ from the isolated incident at Barrackpur?
Meerut was the tipping point because it involved collective organized defiance followed by an immediate tactical decision.
Okay.
A few days prior, 85 troopers of the 3rd Bengal Light Cavalry flatly refused to accept the new cartridges during a parade.
85 of them.
The British response was draconian. They court-martialed the men, sentenced them to 10 years of hard labor, stripped them of their uniforms in front of the entire garrison, and shackled them in irons.
Humiliating them in front of their peers.
It was a disastrous psychological miscalculation. The next day, May 10th, which was a Sunday, the remaining sepoys in the garrison broke.
They just snapped.
They mutinied, stormed the jail to free their 85 comrades, killed several British officers and civilians, set fire to the cantonment, and made a highly strategic decision. They immediately marched overnight toward Delhi.
Why Delhi? It is a mutiny of cavalrymen. They just broke their friends out of jail. They are furious.
Mm-hmm.
Why not secure Meerut or head to their home villages? Why march on the old capital?
Because without a political objective, they're just a mob of mutineers waiting to be hunted down by the British army.
Right.
Marching on Delhi was a search for legitimacy. Delhi was the historical seat of the Mughal Empire. By capturing Delhi, they were attempting to elevate a localized military breakdown into a sovereign political revolution.
They arrived in Delhi on May 11th, seized the city, and confronted Bahadur Shah II.
Yes.
Now, this is a fascinating dynamic from the sources. You have thousands of heavily armed, aggressive, mutinous soldiers showing up at the palace of an 82-year-old pensioner.
It is quite a scene. Bahadur Shah II possessed no real military power. He spent his days writing poetry and living off a stipend provided by the East India Company.
He was completely dependent on them.
The British had already informed him that upon his death, his heirs would have to vacate the Red Fort and lose the imperial title. He was an emperor in name only.
Yet the soldiers demand he lead them.
He initially hesitated, understandably so. He had no treasury to pay them and no administrative apparatus to govern them.
Right, he had nothing.
But the soldiers essentially forced his hand, proclaiming him Shahenshai Hind, Emperor of India.
And his symbolic value is what mattered.
His symbolic value was absolute. To the millions of people across the subcontinent, the Mughal Emperor, however diminished, was still the legitimate sovereign.
So they use him to validate the uprising.
By placing him at the head of the movement, the sepoys transformed their military grievance into a war to restore the old political order.
Once that news ripples outward that Delhi has fallen and the Mughal Emperor is back in power, the entire Gangetic Plain fractures.
It really does.
The administrative control of the East India Company just vanishes in a matter of weeks. We see uprisings in Kanpur, Lucknow, Jhansi, Bareilly, and Bihar. But when you examine the mechanics of this spread, it was not a unified, centrally planned operation.
Not at all. It was highly decentralized. You can think of it as a series of concurrent regional wars of liberation operating under the very loose, nominal umbrella of the Mughal Emperor.
So no central command?
There was no central high command issuing orders from Delhi to the other fronts. The rebellion in each region was spearheaded by local aristocrats and leaders who had their own specific localized scores to settle with the company.
Let us examine one of these leaders in depth, because her story illustrates the complexity of the resistance perfectly. I want to talk about Rani Lakshmibai of Jhansi.
Ah, yes.
She is often portrayed in popular history as this immediate, fiery warrior queen who wanted war from day one. But the historical reality is far more bureaucratic and reluctant at first.
Born Manikarnika Tambe, she became the queen of Jhansi through marriage to the Maharaja. In 1853, her husband died.
And they had no biological heir?
They did not have a biological son, but they had formally adopted a boy, Damodar Rao, complete with all the necessary Hindu religious rites the day before the Maharaja's death.
And this is where Lord Dalhousie's doctrine of lapse swings into action again.
Precisely. Dalhousie refused to recognize Damodar Rao's claim to the throne. The East India Company annexed Jhansi, seized the state jewels, deducted her husband's debts from her modest pension, and ordered her to leave the fort.
Did she immediately declare war?
No. And this is crucial to understanding the political sophistication of the time. She initially attempted to fight the company using their own legal system.
She hired a lawyer.
She hired a British lawyer, John Lang, and sent petitions directly to London, arguing that her husband's dynasty had been famously loyal to the British and that the adoption was legally and religiously sound.
So she tried to play by their rules.
She tried to navigate the bureaucratic channels. It was only when her appeals were entirely dismissed and the 1857 rebellion reached Jhansi, causing British civil authority to collapse, that she was forced into a corner.
The British accused her of complicity in the massacre of British officers in Jhansi, which she vehemently denied.
Right.
But once she realized the British intended to hold her responsible regardless, and with her territory under threat from neighboring rival princes taking advantage of the chaos, she took up arms.
And once committed, her transformation was absolute. She organized the defense of her city, cast new cannons, recruited a massive volunteer force, including a unit of female soldiers, and personally led her troops in battle.
That is a remarkable shift.
When Jhansi fell to British siege, she tied her adopted son to her back, escaped the fortress on horseback at night, and joined forces with other rebel leaders like Tantia Tope.
And she fought until the end.
She fought a mobile guerrilla campaign until she was killed in combat in Gwalior in June 1858. General Hugh Rose, the British commander who fought her, famously noted that she was the bravest and best military leader of the rebels.
Her story is detailed heavily in the sources, but it also highlights the fatal flaw of the rebellion. You have brilliant, motivated local leaders like Lakshmibai fighting in Jhansi. You have Nana Saheb fighting in Kanpur to regain his father's pension, and Kunwar Singh fighting in Bihar to protect his estates.
Yes.
But they are largely fighting their own isolated wars.
The lack of a unified command structure meant the British could isolate and defeat these rebel strongholds sequentially.
Right.
The insurgent leaders rarely coordinated troop movements across long distances, and they failed to establish a unified logistical network to supply their forces.
And while the macro-level strategy was flawed, the micro-level reality of the conflict was characterized by a rapid descent into absolute unmitigated brutality.
It was incredibly dark.
Both sides engaged in acts of horrific violence that fundamentally altered the psychology of the war. We need to examine the siege of Kanpur.
Kanpur, modern-day Kanpur, was a major commercial and military hub. The British garrison there was commanded by General Hugh Wheeler.
And Wheeler was an old India hand, right?
He was. He had an Indian wife, spoke the language fluently, and genuinely believed his sepoys would remain loyal despite the news from Meerut in Delhi.
He was wrong.
Tragically wrong. On June 4th, the troops mutinied, looted the treasury, and aligned themselves with Nana Saheb. Wheeler had to retreat, but instead of fortifying the easily defensible magazine, he chose a highly vulnerable, flat patch of land and threw up a meager mud wall.
The entrenchment at Kanpur is a study in desperation in these historical accounts. You had roughly 900 people inside,
yes,
a mix of British soldiers, loyal Indian troops, and hundreds of civilian women and children. They were trapped in the baking June heat with minimal water, subjected to round-the-clock artillery bombardment by Nana Saheb's forces.
The conditions inside that entrenchment were horrific. The single well they had for water was targeted by rebel snipers. People were dying of sunstroke, cholera, and constant artillery fire.
After 3 weeks of this nightmare, on June 25th, Wheeler accepts an offer of terms from Nana Saheb.
Nana Saheb offered safe passage for the survivors down the Ganges River to Allahabad. On the morning of June 27th, the survivors, starving, wounded, and exhausted, marched down to the Satatura Ghat to board the waiting thatch-roofed boats.
But the safe passage was a trap.
As soon as the British boarded the boats, the Indian boatmen jumped overboard and the thatch roofs were set on fire.
Just a complete ambush.
Rebel troops hidden along the riverbanks opened fire with muskets and grapeshot. The vast majority of the men were killed right there in the river.
It is an absolute slaughter. But the sequence of events that follows is what etched Kanpur into the dark consciousness of the British Empire.
Yes.
The surviving women and children, Around 200 people were pulled from the river and taken captive.
They were held in a small dwelling known as the Bibi Ghar. 2 weeks later, as a British relief column commanded by General Henry Havelock was fighting its way toward the city, a decision was made by the rebel leadership to execute the prisoners, presumably to eliminate them before the British could rescue them. But when the sepoys refused to carry out the order to kill unarmed women and children, butchers from the local market were sent into the Bibi Ghar.
The sources recount this very grimly.
The prisoners were hacked to death, and their dismembered remains were thrown down a nearby well.
When Havelock's troops arrived the next day and discovered the blood-soaked rooms and the well,
it broke the British military discipline and replaced it with a policy of institutionalized vengeance.
It shifted the conflict from a military suppression to a racial holy war. The phrase, "Remember Cawnpore," became a justification for total war.
Yes. When Brigadier General James Neill took command of the area, he instituted a policy of horrific psychological and physical torture.
What did he do?
He forced captured rebel soldiers, regardless of whether they were actually present at the Bibi Ghar, to lick the blood off the floors before hanging them.
And the British forces engaged in indiscriminate violence across the countryside, burning entire villages and hanging local civilians from trees along the Grand Trunk Road. The violence lost all pretense of justice.
It was terror as a military strategy. The brutality of Cawnpore dictated the absolute ferocity of the subsequent sieges, most notably the siege of the Lucknow Residency, because the British inside Lucknow knew exactly what would happen to their families if they surrendered.
Let us move to Lucknow. The residency in Lucknow was a sprawling complex of buildings, spanning about 1,000 yards, acting as the British administrative headquarters in the recently annexed state of Awadh.
Yes.
The chief commissioner, Sir Henry Lawrence, saw the rebellion coming and fortified the compound.
At the end of June, the British were defeated at the Battle of Chinhaut, just outside the city, and retreated into the residency. They were immediately surrounded by an insurgent army numbering in the tens of thousands, commanded in part by Begum Hazrat Mahal, the brilliant wife of the deposed Nawab.
The scale of the siege of Lucknow is claustrophobic. Just days into the siege, Henry Lawrence is killed by an artillery shell exploding in his room.
Right. Command falls to Lieutenant Colonel John Inglis.
You have around 1,600 defenders holding a perimeter of crumbling buildings against constant, highly accurate artillery fire. And the rebels employ mining tactics.
Because the rebels could not simply storm the fortified walls without taking massive casualties, they dug tunnels underneath the British positions, packed them with gunpowder, and attempted to blow the defenses apart from below.
The British response was led by Captain Peter Fulton, who organized a countermining operation.
Yes!
You have British and loyal Indian sappers digging tunnels in absolute pitch darkness, listening for the sound of rebel pickaxes, trying to intercept the enemy tunnels and blow them up before the rebels could detonate their charges under the Redan battery. It is subterranean, terrifying warfare.
I want to highlight a critical detail you just mentioned. The loyal Indian sappers. There is a pervasive, simplistic narrative that 1857 was a united Indian population rising up against the British. The demographic reality inside the Lucknow residency obliterates that myth.
Explain that, because it fundamentally changes how we view the conflict based on the text.
Out of the roughly 1,600 soldiers defending the Lucknow residency against the rebel army, 712 of them were Indian soldiers.
Nearly half the defensive force.
Nearly half. These were sepoys who chose to remain loyal to their British officers, suffering the exact same starvation, disease, and constant bombardment as the Europeans, fighting against their own countrymen outside the walls.
Why did they stay? If the rebellion was a national uprising, why would 700 men choose to starve in a besieged compound for the company?
Motivations varied wildly. For some, it was a deep adherence to their military oath. For others, it was the personal charisma and leadership of specific officers like Henry Lawrence who had treated them with respect.
So it was very specific to the individual.
It underscores the fact that loyalties in 1857 were highly localized, fractured, and deeply personal. It was not a monolith.
The relief of Lucknow takes months.
Yeah.
General Havelock and Sir James Outram manage to fight their way into the compound in September, but they take so many casualties doing it that they are effectively trapped themselves.
They just added more mouths to feed to the seats.
Exactly. It is not until November that Sir Colin Campbell arrives with a massive force of 4,500 men to finally break the siege.
Campbell's advance was brutal. The defining moment was the storming of the Secunderbagh.
What was that?
A walled garden on the outskirts of the city, heavily fortified by rebel troops. Campbell's artillery blasted a small hole in the wall, and British Highland regiments and Sikh troops poured through the breach.
The resulting close quarters combat was a slaughter.
The British troops, still fueled by the memory of Cawnpore, trapped roughly 2,000 rebel soldiers inside the walled garden. They used the bayonet.
All of them.
Almost none of the 2,000 defenders escaped. It was a tactical breakthrough, allowing Campbell to evacuate the civilians from the residency, but the sheer scale of the violence reflects the total breakdown of any rules of engagement.
Campbell evacuates the civilians, falls back, consolidates, and returns in March 1858 with a massive army of 20,000 men to finally clear Lucknow of insurgents.
Yes.
Which brings us to the macro-level resolution. The rebels had the element of surprise. They vastly outnumbered the British initially. They held the major armories. Why did this massive uprising fail?
It failed due to a combination of internal fragmentation among the rebels and the overwhelming global logistical power of the British Empire.
Let's break that down. The internal fragmentation. We mentioned the lack of a unified command, but it was deeper than just tactics, right?
It was ideological and regional. The rebellion was largely confined to the Gangetic Plain in central India. The Bombay Army and the Madras Army in the south remained largely loyal to the company. Many of the powerful princely states like Hyderabad, Gwalior, and the Rajputana states calculated that the British would ultimately win, and they actively assisted the company to preserve their own power.
And the most devastating strategic blow to the rebels came from the Punjab.
The role of the Punjab is the strategic key to the British victory. The Punjab had recently been conquered by the East India Company in the 1840s after brutal wars with the Sikh Empire.
Okay.
Ironically, the British had used the Bengal army, the very high-caste sepoys now mutinying, to conquer the Sikhs.
So there is deep historical enmity between the Sikhs in the Punjab and the mutinying sepoys, whom they called Purbiyas, or Easterners.
Exactly. The Sikhs had no desire to support a rebellion that aimed to restore the Mughal emperor in Delhi, given the historical persecution of the Sikhs by the Mughal Empire.
Right.
Nor did they want to ally with the Bengal army soldiers who had just defeated them a decade prior. The British administrators in the Punjab, like John Lawrence, immediately recognized this.
So they capitalized on it.
They aggressively recruited Sikh and Gurkha troops, promising them the opportunity to march on Delhi and loot the Mughal capital.
The British essentially leverage historical regional hatreds to build a massive counterinsurgency force.
Yes. By 1858, the British had raised over 100,000 native troops, predominantly from the Punjab and Nepal, to fight the Bengal army rebels.
And the British utilized their technological advantages, too.
They did. They controlled the nascent telegraph network, allowing them to coordinate troop movements across the continent instantly, while rebel leaders relied on messengers on horseback.
And the British had the ability to pull resources from a global empire. When the rebellion broke out, they intercepted troops that were sailing for China and diverted them to Calcutta.
They shipped in battle-hardened regiments that had just finished fighting the Russians in the Crimean War.
So the rebels were fighting a finite war of attrition, while the British had an infinite supply chain.
This systemic superiority culminated in the British assault on Delhi in September 1857.
Which was a turning point.
The recapture of Delhi was a grueling street-by-street bloodbath, but strategically, it was the end. The British captured Bahadur Shah II, murdered his sons, and exiled the emperor to Rangoon.
By removing the symbolic center of gravity, the British fractured the rebellion back into isolated pockets of resistance, which they spent the next year systematically crushing.
Yes.
The military victory was total, but the political fallout in London was immediate. The rebellion proved beyond any doubt that allowing a private corporation to govern a subcontinent through an aggrieved mercenary army was a catastrophic failure.
The East India Company had to be dismantled.
How did that happen?
The British Parliament stepped in swiftly. On August 2, 1858, they passed the Government of India Act. This legislation formally abolished the East India Company.
Okay.
All of its territories, its administrative apparatus, and its armies were transferred directly to the authority of the British Crown.
This marks the official beginning of the British Raj.
Yes, it does. The administrative structure was overhauled. The Board of Control in London was replaced by a new cabinet-level position, the Secretary of State for India.
And in India.
In Calcutta, the title of Governor General was upgraded to Viceroy, serving as the direct representative of the British monarch.
To pacify the population, Queen Victoria issued a proclamation in November 1858, It sounds incredibly benevolent on paper when you read it.
It does.
She promises an end to territorial annexations, officially burying the doctrine of lapse. She promises strict non-interference in Indian religious practices. And she promises equal protection and equal opportunity under the law for all her subjects, regardless of race or creed.
The proclamation was a masterclass in political rhetoric aimed at neutralizing the specific grievances that caused the 1857 uprising.
But in reality.
However, the actual policies implemented by the British administration were not focused on benevolence. They were focused on rigorous, systemic control designed to ensure a mutiny could never happen again.
How did they restructure the military to prevent another uprising?
They applied a strict doctrine of divide and rule. First, they fundamentally altered the racial ratio.
Right.
Before the mutiny, it was 5-1. Under the new system, in the Bengal Army, the ratio was fixed at 1 European soldier for every 2 Indian soldiers. In Madras and Bombay, it was roughly 1-3.
And if I'm reading the sources right, they also changed who they recruited, yeah.
Drastically. The British developed the pseudoscientific martial races theory.
What's that?
They actively stopped recruiting high-caste Brahmins and Rajputs from Awadh, blaming them for the mutiny. Instead, they heavily recruited from the groups that had aided them, the Sikhs, the Gurkhas, and the Pathans.
Okay, so they shifted the demographics completely.
Furthermore, they stopped creating homogenous regiments. They mixed different castes, religions, and ethnicities within the same battalions, assuming that internal prejudices would prevent them from ever uniting against their British officers.
That is highly calculated.
And most importantly, they mandated that all artillery and critical arsenals remain exclusively in the hands of European personnel.
They also moved to consolidate their administrative power through legal codification. They needed a standardized way to govern this massive territory. This leads to the implementation of the Indian Penal Code, drafted by Lord Macaulay decades earlier, but rushed into enactment in 1860.
The Indian Penal Code was designed to replace the patchwork of Hindu, Islamic, and local laws with a single, uniform criminal code.
Which, on the surface, standardization seems progressive.
But the code contained mechanisms of absolute political control. The most infamous is Section 124A, introduced shortly after, which codified the crime of sedition.
Define how they use sedition.
Section 124A made it a criminal offense to excite or attempt to excite disaffection towards the government established by law in India.
That is very broad.
It was incredibly broad. It gave the colonial state the legal authority to crush any political dissent, any journalistic criticism, and any nascent nationalist organizing. It was a direct legal response to the trauma of 1857.
And we have to address the glaring hypocrisy in the legal system here. Queen Victoria promised equal treatment under the law, but the reality of the Code of Criminal Procedure, enacted in 1861, included explicit extraterritorial jurisdiction for Europeans.
This is a critical point. Extraterritoriality meant that a British citizen living in India could not be tried by an Indian judge in a district court.
So they were exempt from local judgment.
If a British planter committed a crime against an Indian peasant, the British citizen had the legal right to demand a trial by a European judge and a European jury.
So the law is equal, unless you're white.
The legal framework established after 1857 created a veneer of bureaucratic stability, but it fundamentally institutionalized racial hierarchy.
Right.
The East India Company's chaotic exploitation was replaced by the Crown's efficient, cold, and legally sanctioned authoritarianism.
The physical battles ended in 1858, but the ideological battle over how to define this conflict has raged ever since. The nomenclature, what we actually call this event, is heavily loaded. Let us analyze the historiography.
How a society names a conflict dictates how it remembers the legitimacy of that conflict.
Sure.
In the immediate aftermath, British politicians and historians, such as Sir John Kay, aggressively framed the event as a sepoy mutiny.
Why is the word mutiny so vital to the colonial narrative?
Because a mutiny implies a localized, unjustified breakdown of military discipline. By framing it as a sepoy mutiny, the British actively diminished the massive civilian participation.
They just wrote it out of the story.
They erased the thousands of peasants, the displaced landlords, and the deposed royalty who fought. It allowed the British to argue that their rule in India was fundamentally just and beneficial, and the violence was merely the result of superstitious, ungrateful soldiers upset over a rifle cartridge.
It sanitizes the economic exploitation. But fast forward 50 years, and we see the birth of the Indian nationalist movement. They need a unifying historical narrative. and a key figure steps forward. Vinayak Damodar Savarkar.
In 1909, Savarkar published a highly influential book titled The Indian War of Independence of 1857.
So he completely flips the narrative.
Savarkar totally inverted the British narrative. He argued that the uprising was not a spontaneous, fragmented mutiny, but rather a premeditated, freely coordinated national struggle to overthrow foreign imperialism.
Savarkar is the one who popularized the idea of a secret network of communication, right?
Yes. He highlighted the historical phenomenon of chapatis, unleavened flatbreads, and lotus flowers being passed from village to village by runners in the months leading up to the violence.
Explain the chapatis. Was it actually a secret code?
Historical consensus today suggests the passing of the chapatis was likely a rural ritual intended to ward off a cholera epidemic, and most of the village watchmen passing them had no idea what they meant.
Okay, so maybe not a grand conspiracy.
But Savarkar weaponized that ambiguity. He framed the chapatis as a sophisticated, clandestine signaling system, proving that the entire subcontinent was planning a unified strike. He elevated figures like Rani Lakshmibai and Bahadur Shah into the founding pantheon of Indian nationalism.
Savarkar's book was immediately banned by the British for sedition. But his framing raises a difficult question for modern historians reading these sources.
Yes, it does.
Based on the mechanics we've discussed today, the fragmented leadership, the lack of a central ideology, the fact that the Punjab and southern India fought for the British, can we accurately call it a national war of independence? Did the concept of an Indian nation even exist in 1857?
That is the nexus of modern post-colonial scholarship. Contemporary historians argue that framing it strictly as a mutiny is imperial apologia, but framing it as a unified national war is retroactive nationalist myth-making.
So what was it?
It was a massive, diverse, anti-colonial insurgency. It was a coalition of the displaced. The sepoys fought for their caste and religion. The Teladars fought for their land rights. The princes fought for their sovereign dynasties, and the peasantry fought against crushing taxation.
They all had their own reasons.
They did not share a cohesive vision for a modern, democratic Indian nation. Most of the leaders were fighting to restore the fragmented feudal order that existed before the East India Company arrived. They were united primarily by what they wanted to destroy, not by what they wanted to build.
It is the ultimate collision between an aggressive, expanding corporate empire and a highly complex, traditional society pushed past the breaking point. The sheer trauma of that collision destroyed the East India Company and forced the British Crown to take direct control of the subcontinent.
And in doing so, it set the structural trajectory for the next century of global history.
Which brings us to a final provocative thought for you to consider. The British government studied the rebellion of 1857 deeply. They realized that a fragmented India was a threat to their rule. So they spent the next half century building the ultimate tools of centralized control. They built a sprawling, unified railway network to move troops quickly. They created a highly centralized bureaucratic government in Calcutta and later New Delhi.
They enforced a single, unified legal framework across the subcontinent.
And crucially, they instituted English as the standardized medium of higher education and administration to create a class of native clerks to run their empire.
The historical irony here is profound.
Really profound.
The British intentionally engineered this unified infrastructure to ensure they could effectively monitor, divide, and subjugate a vast, diverse population.
But consider what happens 90 years later, when leaders like Mahatma Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru, and Sardar Patel begin organizing the modern Indian independence movement. They do not fight isolated regional battles like the leaders of 1857.
No, they don't.
They utilize the exact tools the British built. They use the railway network to travel and mobilize masses. They use their British legal education to dismantle colonial laws in court.
And they use the English language to communicate seamlessly across linguistic divides, uniting Bengalis, Punjabis, and Tamils into a single, cohesive nationalist front.
The British spent decades constructing the administrative apparatus of imperial domination to prevent another 1857, unwittingly providing the exact framework required to forge the modern nation of India.
The empire dug its own grave. It just took a century to realize it.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.